People will talk. So, Dr. Chris, thank you very much for joining us just before your event. I will apologize to you on the podcast like this as well for nabbing you beforehand.
You don't need to. It's a pleasure.
You're fresh in from Barcelona, so you're doing... Is this your first time doing these types of events in continental Europe, or...?
Yes, I suppose it is. Yes, yeah, certainly in Spain. I've done a little bit of this kind of thing in the UK, but yeah, overseas. So it's a... unusual experience, but it's been great. Bit of a whirlwind, but it's been really great. Yeah.
So you're a renowned archaeologist, also a personality as well. So what is it like to be those two things at the same time? Recognized, adored, loved.
I kind of want to deny it all, actually. I guess I have an academic background. In the very, very, very small world of Egyptology, it turns out there are a few people who know who I am. This trip to Spain, so we're in Madrid now, of course. I've given a talk here already this week, another one in Barcelona. It seems a lot of people have seen me on the TV, on YouTube, or on social media or whatever, and it's funny, especially for the last 2 years, I've been locked up at home along with the rest of the world, and a lot of people have told me that's where they came across me for the first time. So I guess, you know, this is almost like my first visit to the outside world. And it's a little bit kind of... Yeah, no, it's a little bit overwhelming, but it's really great. It's very, very nice. Nobody's come up to me and said, I saw you on the television, you are awful. So, yeah, all good.
And this is the last question, because we're going to go in a moment. But you've written 4 books, 2 for kids, which is great as well. So do you think Egyptology is also really popular amongst the next generation, and you see a bright future for those coming through school and also eventually university?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely one of those subjects. There aren't very many of them that you can do at school as a kid. That does seem to grab children, and I've had kids coming up to me after both, you know, evening lectures, and this is the lectures I've done here have been, you know, not aimed at kids at all, and yet there have been kids in the audience who have come up, and I've done a few signatures and books and things. And I love the process of writing for kids. It's a very different challenge, but I really enjoy it. And if they enjoy the end product, great. And yes, certainly I've found myself saying "see you in Egypt" to quite a few kind of 10 and 11 year olds in the last few days, so yeah, all good.
Well, Dr. Chris, thank you so much. Enjoy your grilling from Maria, and we'll have a good time. So that was Dr. Chris Naunton at the Secret Kingdoms Bookshop here in Madrid. And we had a wonderful night with him. He was very insightful, very funny, down to earth, a very, very nice man. So Chris, if you're listening to this, thanks for the memories. But apart from Chris, we also have a bit of a coup on the podcast here. We have the woman who was interviewing him, Dr. Maria Correas, ethnoarchaeologist. So how was it for you comparing this event and asking the questions, being the woman controlling the show to a certain extent?
All comparing. No, it was great. I loved it. It was really nice. It was a good opportunity to be able to, both for Chris to be here and you know, and for me to be able to meet up with him after so many years and kind of interview him and well, not so much interview him, but have a chat with him and in front of an audience that were really keen. So It's really nice.
I would love the chance to talk to you in front of an audience.
Well, you have done many times, but also you will have the chance to do it in November when I present my book.
That is very true. I will be asking you the questions because apparently I know the book better than anybody else apart from you. Now, all this will be taking place in the Secret Kingdoms bookshop in Madrid. So a special thank you as well to David Price, who we will be interviewing next week, actually. So that will be up very soon as well. His bookshop, he's running it with his wife. He left the world of banking to set up this bookshop. And basically, he's been running this bookshop for 4 months or so. And the British ambassador was there for the inauguration. He said people like Giles Tremlett of Ghosts of Spain fame there. Dr. Chris as well, of course. So now it's become a center of cultural life. One of the centers of cultural life in Madrid. So it's been very impressive what he's been able to do. So we will delve deeper into that with him when we interview him. Very nice man as well. Been so helpful to us. Likewise with Chris. Dave, if you're listening to this, thank you so much. Now, one thing that we did, we had to clarify on the night was, what the flip is an ethnoarchaeologist? So could you just fill that in for the people?
Oh, well, okay. So ethnoarchaeology is actually not such a well-known branch of archaeology as others, but we basically look at modern remains to learn or understand better the ancient ones. And what joins both modern and ancient is the fact that some traditions to do with architecture, crafts and so on have been preserved through oral history through our millennia, basically.
What's really interesting about this, because this, of course, is a huge part of your book, but it's like when you're learning a language and you hear a new word and suddenly you see that word everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. So my point is here, since we started doing this book together and now it's finished and done, thank God.
Thanks.
there's an element of seeing this kind of crop up in different media and
for
different
you?
Places. Yes, for me.
Oh, truly?
Well, I mean, I don't think she should be surprised, because what I'm going to mention is an experience that we both shared last week at the Fundación Telefónica.
All right, okay.
For example, so we went to see an Australian architect who is also using ancient inspiration for sustainable living in the future.
Are you copying my
it's called paraphrasing, so yeah. There should be a Harvard footnote somewhere here in the description of the podcast. What was interesting in his one was, it was basically the idea that one half of the planet should be just this one mega city, and the other half of the planet should be given to the animals so they can repopulate and their numbers can come back stronger and these things, which is actually linked to an ancient Greek idea, a philosophical idea that all cities would naturally just keep growing until the world was one giant city as well. So anyway, that's just a tangent to show how, you know, I see these things everywhere, and also how it is a rich seam of inspiration, the ancient living for sustainable living in the future. Another paraphrasing of your subtitle of the book.
I think you've read it too many times now.
Just the cover, at least. It was a really nice event. I think for around 45 minutes you were speaking with him. And then afterwards we had questions from the audience, of course. So some of the things you got into, we'll get into here as well for the benefit of the podcast listener. To give a bit of a background about Dr. Chris, he's been on the BBC. He's some kind of a friend of Dan Snow. Not, you know, colleagues, I guess. And also he's written five books, right? Or four?
Well, yeah. I mean, we were talking about four different books that are for the general public, but of course Chris has taken part in author more books in the academic world, you know, the things like when we do academic publications, it's not something really that generally gets read by the general public.
So let's start with one of the books, because this was a field journal of different explorers. So the book was excerpts from dig journeys or dig diaries, I should say, from different archaeologists. Is that how you would sum it up?
It's, well, it's called Egyptologist Notebooks, and yeah, you know, all sorts of things collected, materials collected during excavation, so both writings, maps, plans, drawings, all these things.
You made a great joke about it being a publisher's nightmare. All the high quality pictures. I was laughing.
Yeah, because you felt the pain. It wasn't so much a joke. I was thinking, you know, it takes some guts to actually attempt that, because pretty much the first thing that publishers say is like, oh, we don't want any pictures, or there's certainly not any color pictures allowed.
Well, that is true. In my experience, the compromise there is a QR code on the book sleeve.
Easy now.
And I can go to a website where you have the pictures.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't happen.
Not in your book. No. But this is actually really interesting, because this is really rich primary material created by Dr. Chris, of course. So this opens up a whole host of questions and interests and examples. So the people who were initially coming over to Egypt, the British and the French archaeologists, I guess you could say they have a bit of a mixed legacy, you know. So on one hand, we're very enthusiastic in digging and finding Egyptian culture, but on the other hand, there's a bit of a post-colonial narrative here as well. So that's something I found really fascinating in the discussion, and how even today modern day Egypt is working to maybe correct that by making sure there's always an Egyptian person on the dig and so forth, which we can go into that in just a moment, what the current state of play. But as a Spanish archaeologist, you know, there's no controversial question here, but how do you see, well, foreign archaeologists today perhaps, but also more pointedly, how do you see the archaeologists of yesteryear, you know?
Wow, those are like two very different questions that, you know, could take a series of podcasts. Well, to answer the first one, obviously, even Chris was talking about this, how, you know, you have missions, archaeological missions from so many countries, you know, including Egypt, of course. And so, yeah, the Spanish missions, I don't know if there's any Irish mission. I need to look into this, to be honest. I'm not entirely sure.
Or if it's like the Holy Ghost in Africa or something, that kind of mission.
No, I'm talking archaeological missions again. there are certainly Irish and Northern Irish archaeologists working in Egypt, that's for sure. And in Egyptian museums as well. Also the people that work in the digs, he was pointing this out, and so was a member of the public. They are tremendously skillful, and they've been doing it ever since archaeology or archaeological excavation started in Egypt from European countries. You know, they've always been assisted by Egyptian workers, who are actually the ones that do the hard work of the actual dig. And even, you know, some people, some specific groups became really famous for it, like the Kuftis, that were, you know, a kind of ethnic group that everybody wanted to have in their excavations, because they were so good at working the land down. So yeah,
because even some archaeologists who've studied it might be able to run a dig, but I think even Dr. Chris said himself he never really managed to use a trowel very well, and because you're supposed to work with the soil and know when the feel of the soil against the back of the trowel tells you when it's changing to another period and everything as well. So it is a quite sophisticated and delicate operation to dig down, as you said yourself. How about you? Are you handy with a trowel?
No, I must admit, I really, you know, empathize with what you were saying. No, when I was working in Egypt, I was focusing on mud brick for, I would say, 80% of the time, and 20% of the time pottery, which is another task that, you know, fine processing and all this is also a massive part of excavation. So, you know, everything that comes out needs to be properly, not just recorded, but, you know, cataloged and drawn and described, and all this is basically amounts to the most of the work that gets done in the field. So this has to be done by somebody. And certainly there are also Egyptians doing this, you know, in the pottery team, in the recording findings and so on. But yeah.
Okay, so now moving to another book that Dr. Chris has written. He's written two. He tells a story, or he told us a story at the events where he was near, I think, the tomb of Tutankhamun. And he had this urge, this revelation that, you know, we've been telling their stories for a long time, but why don't we give the voice back to them? So that's why we have the story for kids of Cleopatra Tells All. She's like an influencer. And also Tutankhamun, he's not really billed as an influencer, but again, he tells all and tells his own story as well. So I think this is an interesting thing, because I think in general, Egyptology has a hold over people in the same way that other cultures don't. The Romans and the Greeks, certainly we all know that they have a central place in human civilization, but there's something about Egypt that really pulls people in. And I think this is going to continue with the younger generations. Do you think you've read these books as well? I've read them. They're jam-packed full of facts. As an archaeologist, does it give you pleasure to see how these children will be reading these books and the future of archaeology and Egyptology is somewhat secure?
Well, very much. I mean, of course, we're always very happy. To be honest, Egypt is always a topic that interests people, and especially children. But it's just nice, you know, that they can get that extra information. It's not just the typical thing that you can access everywhere, you know, the stereotypical sort of like pyramid, mummy, you know, gold, that sort of thing. But the books are actually full of facts and curious facts and, you know, just entertaining things, but that are also informative. So I think that's a guarantee, you know, if you want to buy a book like for kids, that if you do buy one written by an Egyptologist, then you know what's in it is gonna be legit, because all the times you come across things that are inaccurate, and you know, just because it's for children doesn't mean it should be inaccurate. So
you did say that writing these types of books presented a separate set of challenges, which I can imagine, but I do understand the power of these books, because I grew up, ironically, compared to what I said just a moment ago, but reading, my first ever book was The Groovy Greeks and the Rotten Romans, my first ever proper history book by Terry Deary, which has now become a bit of a college industry, really. So it survived through the generations, but that was definitely my awakening towards history, which subsequently led me to a history degree in UCC and a lack of gainful employment in that sector. But, you know, I enjoy history, so it's okay.
And yeah, it's a common disease.
My brother bought me those books for Christmas one year, and he's like, why aren't you reading them yet? You know, and that also pushed me into history. So I think strong-arming is also a good tactic as well. Now, in that question to you, I did touch on the fact that Egypt does have that hold over people. It's probably an unanswerable question, but why does it have such a cachet compared to the Greeks and the Romans?
It is a tricky question. I think, I don't know, I assume it's probably because of all this, you know, gold and all this apparel.
Bling.
I think, yeah, in a way bling, but, well, I guess from the beginning, you know, it's been sold, I suppose, in a way, and that's partially, or that's mostly for a long time what's funded the work there, you know, the fact that people were so excited about it. But of course, this cover is like Tutankhamun's tomb. I mean, it's probably, you know, the richest in terms of material culture of any other culture, you know. You've got, well, there are different ones in Mesopotamia, in China, but I suppose it's just the fact that everything is so well preserved, and I think that's something that makes people feel that they feel very close to that era, and they almost feel like they know the ancient Egyptians because of that.
Dr. Chris did mention that, actually. He says that he wanted to recreate in one of his books the feeling that you could open a tomb that had been sealed off for 3,000 years, and you're stepping back into that moment because everything had been perfectly preserved as well. I think also what we can say about Egypt is that there's also some element of the unknown, because Cleopatra's tomb has not been discovered. We also spoke how Alexander's tomb has not been discovered either. So the idea is, like all the queens as well, I believe their tombs are still to be discovered, right? Is there something there that there's a lot of undiscovered, or the wives of the pharaohs more so?
Yes. Yeah, I think you're talking mostly about the 18th dynasty in, yeah, Nefertiti and all, yeah, the women related to Tutankhamun.
I have royalty in my mind at the moment, not only with what happened in the UK, but also the Danish queen stripped four of her grandchildren of their prince and princesses thing, and now they're just ordinary duchesses and things like that. Why am I talking about that? It's the same thing here. So like, they're the wives of the pharaoh, they're the queens. I don't know what their denominations are. It's changing all the time in this royal world, but they're very important people anyway, no?
Yes, but there was like the great royal wife, and then there were lots of other minor wives in ancient Egypt. So I think that's what you're talking about.
I think that's what I was talking about as well. So I've kind of asked you the questions I thought that were standing out from the event, but what about your recollection of it? When you're speaking to him, what did you think that was? What do you think was relevant in terms of the discussion and interesting highlights?
I think the thing I enjoyed the most was, because there were a couple of questions. The one about, you know, how do you appreciate contributions from kind of like the early era without romanticizing colonialism? That was a hard question. But also another question that I felt a bit, it just touched on like controversial things, and I wanted to hear what his thoughts were. Was the one about including theories in his Lost Tombs of Egypt book, which is the last one that we're going to talk about and that he was presenting, or that we were discussing in the event. He talks about those tombs that you've mentioned that haven't been found, but apart from including academic theory, he also includes all the theories, what I called the in-between theories, which are not kind of like pseudo-archaeology, but they are not strictly linked to academic institutions. And I was very impressed by his answer, to be fair. I mean, you know, there's always the point to be made of like, well, if it's not linked to an academic institution, then, you know, what are the credentials? What is the guarantee of that person that is likely in the investigation? You know, how do they prove themselves? But then at the same time, I mean, he made a very good argument that it is true that there's a lot of speculation and a lot of random theories in Egyptology or related to Egypt, to ancient Egypt. And by including those theories that are a bit more in between, you know, that are might not necessarily always be right, but they put forward other arguments and I suppose come from other points of view that might be slightly different to academia, and also have all the media to be able to present them to the general public and to reach the general public with them. I must admit, I was very skeptical about this at the beginning. But then I think he made a very good argument about how it's enriching at the end to discuss it, because they bring some things, and then, you know, I think the most important thing is like for the public to then have tools to be able to assess and make their own opinions. But of course, that has to be informed. But the only way of like making an informed opinion is to be able to access the information. So anything that means that, as long as everything is, you know, rigorously done and researched, anything that helps bringing that closer to the public is bound to help the discipline in general. So,
interesting stuff. All right, I do remember that part of the conversation as well. Now, finally, I think we can talk about how he touched upon, you know, on the BBC and things, it's always Student Comoon, or it's always Cleopatra, it's never something, maybe it's more obscure, because at the end of the day, these institutions are businesses, and that's why we have independent history podcasts cropping up, like the History Hit podcast, for example, because they're taking matters in their own hands and covering stories that they're passionate about, you know, instead of just catering to traditional broadcasters and the remit of, well, what's popular and financially viable. So with that in mind, if you had a podcast or a documentary on the BBC or whatever it is,
I was thinking I don't have a podcast.
If you had your own History Hit podcast, what aspect of Egyptian culture would you focus on or like to cover that's outside the traditional, you know, stuff like
I thought you were gonna say that's outside your book, because you're always hanging on about your book. Well, actually, everything in my book. No, I mean, organic materials, I know I'm always a pain, but it's just as I was explaining earlier on about how people are fascinated by how everything has been so well preserved that they feel really close to it, like Tutankhamun's, you know, bed and chariot and things like that. Then, you know, if they knew everything that has been preserved of like daily life in Egypt, you know, from like children toys, like articulate toys, to, you know, brooms, to like balls of rag, you know, just a whole lot of things that I think are just so fascinating. I mean, bread, all kinds of food. I don't know, I think, you know, I have seen how excited people get about it when, you know, when you take into the museum and they see all these things. And it's just unknown to them. So I think if that part of ancient Egyptian history was better known, I think people would find it equally fascinating, you know. I know sometimes people want to just evade themselves and think, oh, I'm just interested, you know, like when they read like a gossip magazine and I'm just interested in like the high life or whatever, upper classes, and it's far more glamorous and I don't want to see things that are like everyday life. But at the end of the day, that's probably what most people feel, you know, empathize with, and it makes them feel closer to the past. So that's what I would go for.
It's a very passionate answer. I love that. I think as well with Tutankhamun, not only is it a popular subject, but also we perhaps focus more on his death than his life. Because when we were translating, and we were translating the exhibition for, that's going to be in the Matadero of Tutankhamun, if we can say that publicly. So if you're in Madrid and see that, that was our translation. Well, mostly yours, yeah, let's be fair. Okay, I'm sorry for stealing credit from you in that regard. But I learned, I'm not sure if I learned it there, but but Khamun, the part of his name, I mean, he's named after the god he worshipped, right? So it's like you would be Maria Khamun if you're like a Khamun worshipper.
Ah, right, I see what you're getting at.
So, you know, I mean, there's a whole element there, and I think that sect fell out of favor as well after he died. That there's like, so there's all these, this intrigue and tensions Marilis, between gods. Yes. So like, where's all that? I mean, do people talk about that? Or they do? They do.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, well, then fair enough, you know.
Well, but the thing is, like, at the end of the day, it's such a short period. It's just like 50 years in like 3,000 years.
Yeah.
So it's actually, I mean, the
In the in-between kingdom.
Indeed. No, the beauty of it is that, I mean, we know so much because he... you know, Akhenaten came up with a new kabbalah, came up with a new religion, although it was based on very old-fashioned version of religion. But yeah, it was so kind of like specific that he actually, yeah, that we know so much about it, also so little, of course. But I mean, so much in terms of that snippet of like 50 years within 3,000 years. It's actually amazing that it's such a big thing.
Fascinating. Well, Maria Kamun, thank you very much for your contributions. This has been the El Arpa Kamun podcast. Oh, or the People Will Talk Kamun podcast. I keep forgetting we changed the name.
Like 4 years ago.
But thank you all for listening. We do have the David Price interview, the Alvaro interview. We also have an interview with Maria Jose, who's head of a... Not the head of, but she's a big part of an NGO helping Afghani refugees. And also a very, well, relatively well-known translator as well. These are our interviews coming up in future episodes. So this is me saying goodbye.
I'm saying bye.
And good luck.
Good luck and good night. Yeah.